From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch on this Friday in the hot and steamy month of July. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC, filling in for Tony Perkins. Well, kicking off the top stories today, the American Humanist Association is rejoicing that Jesus was just banned from a South Carolina school district, the culmination of a six-year legal battle with the school district itself. I'll talk with First Liberty attorney Latham Watts about the case. In my second segment, Faithful America, like Sojourners, is a sham ministry funded by leftist billionaire George Soros. The purpose is to confuse and divide the Christian vote. And I'll talk with Kristen Eastlick, editor-in-chief of InfluenceWatch.org and senior VP of the Capital Research Center. At the bottom of the hour, the new interim Planned Parenthood president has a history of what else? Aborting the truth. Ryan Bomberger, founder of the Radiance Foundation and TooManyAborted.com, will join me to discuss. And at 42 past the hour, Dr. Walter Williams, the George Mason Professor of Economics and guest host for Rush Limbaugh, will join me about his latest column entitled Things Haven't Always Been This Way. As a reminder, our podcast and simulcast of today's program is at TonyPerkins.com. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, as I've stated, Jesus was just banned from a South Carolina school district and any reference thereof in graduation ceremonies. Federal Judge Brucie Hendricks issued an order against the Greenville County School District banning school-sponsored prayers, religious songs, and the use of religious venues at public school graduations. Judge Hendricks wrote, quote, "This district shall not include a prayer, whether referred to as a prayer, blessing, invocation, benediction, inspirational reading, or otherwise as part of the official program of a graduation ceremony. The district also shall not include an obviously religious piece of music as part of the official program for a graduation ceremony," end quote. Well, joining me now to provide his analysis is First Liberty Institute attorney Latham Watts. Latham, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Latham, I understand that this is sort of the culmination of a very drawn-out, very acrimonious six-year legal battle between the American Humanist Association and the school district. So, to give our listeners a sense of the hostility to our Christian heritage, here is what the American Humanist Association executive director, Roy Speckhart, had to say. Quote, "The school district subjected countless students to school-sponsored prayers on what should otherwise be a celebratory and inclusive occasion for all students, religious or not," end quote. Latham, before we get into the specifics of this particular ruling, I have a philosophical question. So if these atheist groups do not believe that God exists, they seem to be really threatened that people reference him or pray to him in the public square. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, I would agree. And, you know, their typical legal argument, as you hear in his statement, you know, the people were subjected to hearing this. You know, there's the Constitution exists to protect your rights, not your feelings. And if someone was made to feel uncomfortable, you know, that's regrettable. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the Constitution prohibits whatever the activity that made you feel uncomfortable. So it's a specious legal argument, unfortunately, adopted by this judge. But thankfully, the most recent Supreme Court ruling, I think, is going to bring clarity to a lot of these types of things. And this case may be, you know, depending on how the school district wants to proceed, obviously. But if appealed and appellate court applied the Supreme Court's most recent decision in the American Legion versus American Humanist Association, I think you would find that an invocation at a ceremony is in keeping with longstanding history and tradition in this country, and therefore now enjoys a presumption of constitutionality under that opinion. So we'll have to wait and see. But I think we are headed in a new direction now, thanks to that Supreme Court decision, and hopefully we'll see less and less of these types of decisions.
Well, the case that you're referring to, the one we sort of colloquially refer to in shorthand as the Bladensburg Cross decision that the Supreme Court recently issued, was encouraging for a lot of us, I believe, insofar as it proved to us that the standard has really been flipped on its head, right? The initial and original intent of the notion of separation of church and state was to protect the exercise of religion from state intervention, not vice versa. So it sounds like, based on what you've said, you were a little bit surprised by Judge Hendrick's ruling in this case, particularly in light of recent Supreme Court precedent. Were you a little bit taken aback by what she said?
Yes, and it looks like that she applied the court precedent in Lemon versus Kurtzman, which was, you know, the real issue in the Bladensburg World War I memorial case. We not only asked the court to protect the Bladensburg World War I memorial as not a violation of the Establishment Clause, but we asked them to basically abandon their analysis from Lemon versus Kurtzman, which has been known as the Lemon test ever since then. And so it looks like this judge applied Lemon. Now, what I'm not 100% clear on is the timing of you know, when the case was argued, and you know, we know this decision, you know, just came out about a month ago. So there could be a timing issue. However, the good news is going forward, I think, as I said, if the school district appealed this case and the appellate court considered it under the Bladensburg opinion, then I think you know, it's very likely that this could be overturned. Now, I should say this as well. Even before the Supreme Court opinion in the Bladensburg World War I memorial case, First Liberty has litigated issues like this all over the country for many years and won over and over and over again when it comes to especially religious speech of like a valedictorian or an invocation at a ceremony like this. You know, the question is whose speech is it? If it is the school district's speech or is it the speaker's speech?
Right.
Now, obviously, it's the speaker's speech, and that student does not abandon his or her First Amendment rights just by going to a public school. And we've won these cases, you know, multiple times in multiple jurisdictions, even before the Supreme Court case. So I really think this judge got it wrong on multiple levels. So hopefully it will be remedied in the future.
What I particularly dislike about this ruling is that the judge ordered essentially an affirmative review of the students' prepared remarks. So, of course, you get valedictorians or salutatorians to get up. Sometimes they reference their faith in their remarks. She ordered school leaders to remove any references to prayer in graduation remarks should they review those remarks. And if they did not review the remarks, the student speaking would only be allowed to pray, quote, provided that no other persons may be asked to participate or join in the prayer, for example, by being asked to stand or bow one's head, which sounds truly a little totalitarian to me. Not only that they are forcing these school officials to review these comments, which of course can only be interpreted as a matter of private speech and not government-sanctioned speech, they are saying also, make sure no one indicates they are participating in the prayer as well, which I find deeply problematic.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's nonsense to think that, you know, people standing in, even if they're not particularly religious, out of respect or reverence or to solemnify the opening of a ceremony is somehow coercing them to worship. And that's really the standard that the founders intended with the First Amendment, that there would be no established church of the United States of America. And really the analysis of this type of thing should be, if you haven't been coerced into worshiping or in compelled to support some state-approved church, then there is no violation of the Establishment Clause. And that, again, was part of our brief to the court in the American Humanist Association American Legion versus American Humanist Association, or the Bladensburg case. So, yeah, this ordering of school officials to review student remarks. As I said, we've won cases on this in multiple jurisdictions, even before that Supreme Court case, because that speech belongs to the student. It is their speech. It is not the school district's speech. Mm-hmm. And typically the challenges to this sort of thing are along the lines of, well, it's the school district's, the speech is attributable to the school district and that somehow violates the Establishment Clause. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Even if it was the school district speech, they haven't established a religion. They haven't coerced anyone into worshiping or compelled anyone to support a church. But it's clearly not the school district's speech. It's the speaker's speech.
Right.
It is the valedictorian's speech or the salutatorian's speech. And they clearly have a right to express, typically it is something very simple or benign, mention of their faith and its influence on them, or they thank God for the blessings that they've had. It's in no way forcing anyone to worship in violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
Well, I remember these many years ago, and I won't reference a specific number, the choir singing "The Lord Bless You and Keep You" when we had our graduation ceremony in high school all those decades ago. But that's not even a sufficiently appropriate exercise in this event. So this judge is really making sure that there are every vestige of religion is stripped from whatever transpires at that graduation ceremony, which is really an unfortunate elimination, a separation of the free exercise of the religious liberty, of the rights of those students who aren't forced to strip themselves of their beliefs and the exercise of those beliefs when they are out in the public square. So are you anticipating this decision will be appealed?
That's hard to say. I mean, we're not litigating the case. That would be probably up to the school district. If I lived in that school district, I would, for one, be calling my school board members, my elected school board members, telling them that I expect them to appeal this decision and that it will be the basis of my vote in the next school board election. But to your point about the speech or the song or whatever it may be. In Justice Alito's opinion in the Bladensburg World War I Memorial case, he actually said, and this was the problem with women, it turned government hostile towards any sort of religion or display or anything or any mention of religion in the public square. And so what Alito said in his opinion was, any government that's just roaming the land looking to, to cleanse the public square of all things religious is overtly and overly hostile. And that's what we have to get away from. And thankfully, that opinion does.
It is, to quote our friend Todd Starnes, a form of Christ shaming. Lathan Watts, attorney with First Liberty Institute, has been my excellent guest today. You are listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, director of partnerships here, filling in for Tony Perkins on this Friday edition. Coming up next, if you've heard of Faithful America, you need also to think of George Soros. The purpose is to confuse and divide the Christian vote. I'll talk with Kristen Eastlick, senior VP at Capital Research Center, next.
Can United States senators interrogate court nominees on their religious beliefs? This is a controversial question that our country is facing today. In light of this controversy, FRC has taken up the task of answering this question with one of their latest publications, Rebels Without a Clause. We've seen in recent Senate confirmation hearings a troubling pattern arise where senators have begun questioning presidential nominees about their faith as an attempt to discredit them. These interrogations have gone so far as to asking nominees of their theological beliefs, church membership, and associations with faith-based nonprofits. It has been an alarming display of hostility toward religion and people of faith. Visit frc.org/test to learn what questioning the Constitution's No Religious Test Clause allows and forbids in the process of confirming judicial nominees. That's frc.org/test.
The latest Trojan horse on Capitol Hill is called the Equality Act. The way the left is advertising this bill is misleading because it does not further equality at all. It would actually violate current protections in place that allow private institutions and people of faith to freely act in accordance to their deeply held beliefs. The Equality Act explicitly removes religious liberty protections that were originally put in place with bipartisan support. Its stated goal is equality, but its actual result is harm to vast members of communities, individuals, and Americans as a whole by undercutting our foundational freedom of religion. Is this really what equality looks like? A more fitting name for the Equality Act would be the Inequality Act. For more information on the mass threat of the Equality Act, visit frc.org/EqualityAct2019. That's frc.org/EqualityAct2019.
Many advances made by the homosexual movement are based on the claim that sexual orientation is immutable or unchangeable. This belief was a deciding factor in the 2015 Supreme Court case that redefined marriage to include same-sex couples. It has been a key argument for LGB activists fighting to restrict or ban therapies for people seeking help to overcome their same-sex attraction. But is sexual orientation written in stone? Should we brand people with an immovable sexual orientation label and tell them, you can't change, don't try to change, even if they want to? In a new publication from FRC, we reveal that sexual orientation can change. Survey data shows that heterosexuality is largely stable, but homosexuality is not. Even pro-LGB scholars are calling for the immutability argument to be abandoned. The question is, why is the LGB movement pushing this false argument? To learn more, visit frc.org/sexualorientation. That's frc.org/sexualorientation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, filling in for Tony Perkins. A reminder, tonyperkins.com is our podcast site. Well, Faithful America sounds like a benign, in fact, charitable, ministerial organization like Sojourners, but it is a sham ministry. Believe it or not, a name that sounds so good is actually affiliated with an idea so bad. It is funded by leftist billionaire George Soros with the purpose of confusing and dividing the Christian vote, particularly as we turn the corner into the 2020 election season. Well, joining me now is Kristen Eastlick, Editor-in-Chief of InfluenceWatch.org and Senior VP of Capital Research Center. Kristen, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much.
Kristen, I want to get a bird's eye view because for the sort of unschooled and sort of ill-prepared, you hear an organization like Faithful America or Sojourners. These sound like ministry organizations that might align themselves with the religious right, but you've explained and done plenty of research on this. They are not actually faithful to the word of God. Why is their goal to divide the Christian vote and help Democrats get elected?
So this goes back a few years when the Democratic Party started realizing that they were having a hard time working through the larger things like the Democratic National Committee and the DNC. And so large, more liberal funders started looking at other ways to change the way public thinks about issues through nonprofit organizations. It goes back roughly to when, during the 2004 election, when John Kerry did not prevail over George Bush, and there had been a lot of activity in the faith community to reelect George Bush. George Soros and a lot of funders, it was at this time that Democracy Alliance was founded. And Democracy Alliance was founded to start routing money to organizations that could more effectively change the way that public thinks about political issues and public policy issues. And that turned into groups like Faithful America. That was roughly the time that it was founded. Mm-hmm. It turned into groups like the PICO National Network, which is a group originally started as the Pacific Institute for Community Organization, but it does a lot of its work through faith-based groups as well. So there's been for some time some way of trying to change the faith narrative. That's a phrase that Jim Wallace of Sojourners used. So Faithful America actually started out as a project of the National Council on Churches. It then was sponsored by a Soros-funded group called the Faith in Public Life. Mm-hmm. And since 2013, Faithful America has actually been run by an organization called the Citizen Engagement Lab. This is a group of a bunch of community organizers, and in fact, the current executive director of Faithful America is a veteran from Move On, MoveOn.org, which is the organization that got started during the Obama administration and is founded on a lot of Alinskyite, Saul Alinsky community organizing efforts. So this is how the money has flowed to these groups, because by getting boots on the ground, things can change. The way that the public thinks about some of these issues can change more rapidly.
So they've expanded. Faithful America seemed to really expand its initial motivation, which was simply to claim victory in the 2004 election. But now they've sort of expanded it beyond that single election-oriented issue. What does the platform look like now for an organization like Faithful America?
So they are advocating for a lot of the social justice movements that are out there. I'm sure your listeners will know that they claim to have been the group behind having MSNBC not allow representatives from FRC to be interviewed on that network. So they have attacked Family Research Council for some time. Yes. They were involved with another group that is sponsored by the Citizens Engagement Lab called Ultraviolet. They were involved in the Hobby Lobby case, a U.S. Supreme Court case, that helped affirm that a company that is closely held can be exempt from doing things that offend its religious beliefs. And, of course, that gained a lot of backlash from the left. They've been involved in – they've even started considering gun control and even climate change campaigns. They've considered those as victories, and they've used local religious groups to fight against those battles. They brag on their website that a fracking initiative in Kentucky, they used a group of nuns to help push back against that. So it's finding a way of making the faithful communities engage in these more public policy and political activities.
So I've done just a little bit of looking into this, not anywhere near the extent that you have, as having done so much really premier research on the influence of these organizations. But for me to mention names like Faithful America and Sojourners, but also the American Library Association, the ACLU, the American Federation of Teachers, the Center for Reproductive Rights, the Human Rights Campaign, just to name a few, we are often pilloried for having put George Soros as the sort of conspiratorial head of a network of organizations. Is that true?
Well, given that these groups that we just talked about, I mentioned Faith in Public Life, that is an Open Society Foundation's project. And for a while, it housed, Faithful America. And so that's hard to disconnect the Soros funding from that. When you take a look at the Citizen Engagement Lab, that exists because of the Democracy Alliance, which was started as a part of the effort to flow funding into these policy debates. So the connections, you can't really break them because they are there. It may not be only George Soros funding them, but he's behind a lot of it.
Kristen Eastlick has been my guest. She is editor-in-chief of InfluenceWatch.org. For more information, go to InfluenceWatch.org. You will be shocked at what you see in these networks. You are listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins and your director of partnerships. Coming up next, Planned Parenthood has had a number of ups and downs, mostly downs, but the new interim president has a history of aborting the truth. That's the contention of my next guest, Ryan Baumberger, founder of the Radiance Foundation, next up on Washington Watch.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. In a new publication from Family Research Council, we list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, filling in for Tony Perkins on this hot Friday edition. Well, the new interim Planned Parenthood president has a history of aborting the truth. She follows on the heels of Leanna Wen's departure, and that is the contention of my next guest, Ryan Baumberger, founder of the Radiance Foundation and of the site TooManyAborted.com. Ryan, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Here.
Well, Ryan, you never thought that Dr. Leanna Wen, who just resigned from Planned Parenthood, and really it was a firing, let's be fair, would never last. Tell me why you didn't think Wen was cut out for the job.
You know, I remember hearing her first interview on CBS this morning. She sounded so robotic. She sounded like she had rehearsed over and over and over and over again, but it just wasn't coming out. She wasn't nearly as fluid as Cecile Richards, who, you know, had honed her skills over years and years of political activism. I just felt like this is not real. I mean, she's a medical professional. She was an ER doctor, but it didn't sound real. She didn't sound believable. And that's when I first thought, I don't know how this is going to work. She said in the interview, which was kind of laughable, that she's not an activist. You know, I'm a doctor. I'm not an activist. Well, she spent her whole time working overtime being an activist.
Right. Right. And actually, that's the worst way to present yourself, because that's all abortion is through Planned Parenthood. It is an activist organization seeking to activate more money for more abortions. And in fact, you talked about the recent op-ed she had in The Washington Post, and there were a number of bizarre contradictions, weren't there?
You know, it was so tragic to read that. Here she's mourning the loss of a pregnancy. She had a miscarriage. And so the thrust of the article, I thought, was to talk about losing a child, but she never actually mentions child throughout the whole article. In fact, she calls it a potential life, so I'm not sure why you're mourning a potential life, but she used that opportunity, that loss in her life, then to shill for Planned Parenthood, to promote abortion. I don't even know how mentally someone can do that, the kind of acrobatics you have to do in your mind to somehow tell people you've had a tragedy and you were getting over that loss, you were mourning that loss, but, oh, by the way, I'm going to keep on fighting for abortion. What? It's heartbreaking.
Well, tell us a little bit. I want to talk about Alex McGill Johnson, who's the interim Planned Parenthood president. Tell me what your sense is about the fact that this is the activist they've been looking for.
Yes, and she also gives Planned Parenthood a little bit of cover because she's multiracial like I am. She's black and white and something else. I'm not sure what exactly she is. I'm not sure exactly what I am. I know that my biological father was black. I mean, I know what I am and who I am, but I just mean ethnically, I don't know. I'm adopted, and so I don't have those specifics. But she gives them cover because they have been heavily targeting, since their existence, the black community disproportionately, and they have been increasing that targeting over the past few years. So it's not surprising that they have brought her on. Her whole thing at Perception Institute, which is where she talks about race and victimhood mostly, is fitting because what she's doing is saying the reason why, you know, there are negative health disparities are solely because of racism. That's the only explanation. Yet she is now leading the organization that is the leading killer of black lives. While she calls pro-lifers racist. That's
absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, her participation in an Al Sharpton National Action Network conference in 2014 actually caught your attention. What was it about that that really caught your eye?
Doing anything with Al Sharpton? I mean, first of all, I mean, this is not someone who deserves any kind of credibility, but yet, you know, people, you know, genuflect in front of the Reverend Al Sharpton. But she was part of this conference, and in the conference she was talking about basically pro-life efforts are just like those who pushed poll taxes and literacy tests. First of all, that's obviously a historically challenged remark because it was the Democrat Party that pushed poll taxes and literacy tests and all these other eugenic-based social policies, these separate and unequal policies. And so it was a bizarre sort of tirade on how racist pro-lifers were and how people really just had misconceptions about what Planned Parenthood does, that Planned Parenthood isn't just about abortions. Well, that's the only thing that brings you in a lot of your money, 80% of your health services revenue. But she was the board chair at that time, and she was trying to heavily sell all the benefits of Planned Parenthood. Yet the reality is all their major services, major medical services to women have been plummeting for over 10 years. So the only way to kind of, you know, divert from that reality is to, you know, throw out all these lazy racism accusations. But she was part of Al Sharpton's National Action Network conference. So racism is what they do, or at least I should say cries of racism is what they do.
And just as a matter of fact that I think people ought to remember, you point out that Jim Crow racist policies emanated from the Democratic Party, which means she's either ignorant or she's hoping her audience is ignorant.
Well, she and all of mainstream media, or I should say all of the, I should say the majority of mainstream media, I mean, they have this false narrative somehow the Democrat Party was the party of Lincoln, was the party of liberation. Yet it was the party of slavery, the party of the KKK, the party of poll tax and literacy tests, the party of voter suppression, and now the party of unlimited abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's the right activist for them because she will just keep on you know, delivering their planned propaganda every single day. That's what they need.
And she's got every reason to be mad, now understanding that Title X funds don't fall into their coffers anymore. Ryan Bomberger of the Radiance Foundation, who is a deep and longstanding ally of FRC, has been my guest today. You are listening to Washington Watch. We will be watching what happens with Planned Parenthood. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. Coming up next, Dr. Walter Williams joins me about his latest column in the Daily Signal, Things Haven't Always Been This Way. We'll be right back.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide. to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive. Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Did you know that thanks to President Trump, abortion giant Planned Parenthood can no longer receive up to $60 million in federal funding? This new federal protection for the unborn is thanks to a rule change that the Trump administration implemented to the Title X Family Planning Grant Program, which will take effect in May 2019. Not only do the new Title X rule changes take funding away from our nation's largest abortion supplier, they also ensure that taxpayer dollars are not used for abortion and open the door for pro-life pregnancy resource centers and other faith-based organizations to apply for Title X funds, thus expanding the health care options of needy families who are experiencing unexpected pregnancies. For more information about the new Title X rule changes that protect the unborn and increase health care options, visit frc.org/Title X. That's frc.org/Title X.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. I am sitting in for Tony Perkins on this very hot Friday in July. Well, it's an absolute honor to welcome to the show a man who really needs no introduction. Dr. Walter Williams has served on the faculty of George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, as the John Olin Distinguished Professor of Economics, in addition to writing a nationally syndicated weekly column that's carried by about 140 national newspapers. Dr. Williams' most recent documentary is Suffer No Fools, based on Up From the Projects, an autobiography. He is also the substitute host for the Rush Limbaugh radio show. And today we're going to be talking about two of his latest columns, the first entitled Things Haven't Always Been This Way. Dr. Williams, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I must tell you that reading your column made me long for an earlier age. And I hate to say that we need to look backward to move forward, but really, you make such a compelling argument about how we are in a state of cultural deviancy. And you start off with what seems like a crazy idea. So I'm going to quote from your piece. Quote, how about setting up some high school rifle clubs? Students would bring their own rifles to school, store them with the team coach, and after classes, collect them for practice, end quote. So tell me why you decided to start your piece with the idea of a gun club to prevent gun violence.
Well, I just wanted to show the reader how far we've gone. That is, for throughout most of our history, people have youngsters even have had guns, and we didn't have all the murder and shootings and things like this. And many high schools had rifle clubs, and many high schools indeed had shooting ranges in their buildings. And so you say, well, look, any principal or any person in charge of schools today that would suggest that we should have a rifle club in schools and kids be taught how to use rifles and have contests, he would be fired. He would be put into and maybe he'd be imprisoned or put into an insane asylum. So you say, well, what? Why? Well, have guns changed? That is, I asked in the column, has the 30-30 Winchester changed since 1930 or 1940? or 22 rifle, have they just become more violent and go around shooting people? And that's utter nonsense. And so if you recognize that rifles and guns and pistols are inanimate objects and they cannot act by themselves, then it forces you to say, well, gee, if rifles have not changed, and it must be that people have changed. And so it turns out that our country has become more violent. And what a lot of the people who want to take our Second Amendment rights away, they want to say, they suggest that, you know, they even use the term gun violence. That is a 22 rifle just gets up and starts engaging in violence.
Right.
And that's utter nonsense. That is, again, it's an inanimate object and it cannot act on its own. And so we have to ask, well, what has happened to our society? And I use the case of rifles as only a small example of the social deviancy, mm-hmm. or what is considered acceptable behavior compared to yesteryear, that's happened in our society. And I use the examples. I'm almost 84, and so I have the advantage of knowing that things have not always been this way. And things like students cursing the teachers, assaulting teachers. Back when I was coming up, you would never even think of cursing a teacher, much less assaulting a teacher, because if you did so, you would find you would be a whole lot of heat put on your behind by a paddle. But nowadays, people don't do that. I remember when I attended Benjamin Franklin High School, which was the poorest school in Philadelphia. I lived in a poor neighborhood. And the only time we saw a police in school, I graduated in 1954, only time we saw a policeman in school was during an assembly period, and we had to listen to a boring lecture by Officer Friendly about safety. Now, today in Philadelphia, there are 400 and some policemen in schools, protecting. And then also, kids are going through metal detectors, and things that if I told my grandmother that this stuff was existing, she wouldn't believe me. And then other forms of cultural deviancy, things like children addressing adults by their first names, children using foul language in front of adults, and often that was just considered unacceptable.
Well, in some houses like ours, it is still considered unacceptable, although I will tell you, if my children get a hold of this broadcast, they will admit they get to slip every so often if mom's not around to hear it. So I want to talk a little bit about this cultural deviancy, because even when I was growing up in the 70s, I remember such a different way of life, a certain level of morality that did not immediately connect itself to a theology, but there was an inherent moral standard that I remember us adhering to, a level of respect, a level of politeness, of graciousness. And you talk about the fact that really we're in a different social era, and in large part, in addition to the specific examples you've given. I want to talk about the demographic compositions, the differences in some of the data accessible. 29% of white children, 53% of Hispanic children, and 73% of black children are born to unmarried women. Those numbers are staggering.
Yeah, that's right. And being born, without a father president, a president, is not a very, very good way to start off in life. That is, being born and you don't know who or where your father is, that's not a very good start in life. And it turns out that that most prison inmates come from fatherless homes. The suicide rate among kids from fatherless homes is much higher. And many of the negative aspects, high school dropouts, drug addiction, are greater in kids with fatherless homes. And, you know, one of the tragedies of the 60s and 70s, it was taught by sociologists at high school, at colleges, and particularly one called Andrew Cherling at University of Maryland. He says that the kids don't need a father; they need the father's money. And so what he is essentially saying was that a father can be replaced by a welfare check.
Right. Right. And we know that is so inaccurate, that there are specific roles that a mother and father play in the developing psyche, emotions, morals, theology, philosophical development of a child that can't be replaced just with a welfare check. So
that's right. And I'd say something else that I said in my last paragraph. The first line of defense in a society is not the law or the criminal justice system. The first line of defense is the customs, traditions, and moral values. And these behavioral norms are transmitted by example, by word of mouth, by religious teachings, and if these values are not learned, and we increasingly depend on the police to protect us, that says that we are in a sad state of affairs as a society.
How accessible is it for the American populace? And I know we can advance what we want through politics and population, through policy, through education. And here we are very close to, for you, D.C., there you are in Fairfax at George Mason University. And here I am in the nation's capital, and we're at the heart of politics and policy. We can advance the notion of a return to morality. But if you are John Q. Public and you are sitting outside your tenement in Cabrini Green, okay, and I have family in Chicago, I know the area well.
Yeah.
How do you start? What is step one in a return to a system that rebuilds a society from the inside out?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, I think that it would be great, but I just don't know the answer to where to begin. I think that we've downplayed religious teachings. Religious teachings used to be very, very important. That is, religious teachings are like having somebody on your shoulder watching you, and teaches you to engage in the behavior, certain kinds of good behavior, whether somebody's watching you or not. That's very, very important. And then I think that there should be consequences for bad behavior. That is, if a kid curses at a teacher, that is, he ought to be taken to the vice principal's office, just like we did years and years ago, and a paddle put on his butt. And so, and the kid would not curse again like
that. Oh boy, that gets the message through.
that's right. But what we've done as a society, we've replaced acts that work with, we replace things that work with things that sound good. That is, we should be caring, et cetera, et cetera. Those things sound good, but they don't work.
Oh, I love that phrase. We have replaced things that work with things that sound good. In fact, this actually leads a segue into your article that appeared before the one we're referencing, the one on the free speech crisis on college campuses. And this is really an excellent two-part series, whether or not you intended it specifically that way. I love this piece because what it does is it takes that notion of cultural deviancy and that distribution of social justice and what we think feels good and sounds good to the ear. And we've expanded that onto college campuses so that, in the words of Carolyn Rouse, the Princeton University professor, free speech is essentially a baseless ruse for people to say whatever they want in any context with no social, economic, legal, or political repercussions. And so now we are removing gendered language at the University of California, Berkeley. And now they are, instead of manhole covers, work covers, I believe. So we're really in a crisis in higher education as well, aren't we?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We've been in a crisis in higher education for quite some time. And I think that what people need to recognize that the true test of one's commitment to free speech does not come when he allows people to be free to say those things with which he agrees. It comes when he when he allows people to say those things which he finds offensive. And that's the true test for freedom of one's commitment to freedom of speech. And this seems like this is something that this is an idea that wins a hostile reception on many college campuses. You have to say things that are politically correct.
Boy, it does make me wonder what the future holds for my three children, who we have said are all going to college. This is a commitment we've all made together as a family. And yet I find myself shaking a little bit with the anticipation of sending them off into an environment in which the worldview does not permit the true exercise of a fundamental freedom we've been promised from day one, from the founding of this nation. So I do worry a little bit. Is there, in your view, Dr. Williams, is there hope for higher education?
Well, there are some colleges whereby they adhere to the principles of personal liberty. Colleges such as Hillsdale College and Grove City College and a few other colleges, but most colleges are just really bad places. And where kids go to be indoctrinated, and where parents do not recognize their kids after they get through college. That is, they're brainwashed by the faculty members.
Mm-hmm. So
matter of fact, I'd say finally that one has to be very thoughtful. That is, college is not for everyone, and one does not need to go to college to be successful.
I am glad to hear you say that. There is always the possibility that the path goes another route. And as someone who is in a higher education and who has received the benefits of higher education, you yourself recognize that the path is not always a direct one, but can be a circuitous one. And in your words, Dr. Williams, I want to close with the idea that I want liberty for me and liberty for my fellow man. Dr. Walter Williams of George Mason University, Distinguished Professor of Economics, has been my excellent guest today. You have been listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry. I've been sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com, our podcast site. We will catch you next week, and I'll be back with you again on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.